Welcome to Leaders Upgraded, the place where people who want to upgrade and fast track their career, their life, and their leadership journey tend to gather. I am your host, Tanvi Gautam, and I shall be speaking to the top 10% of the world's leading authors, CEOs, coaches, and thinkers to bring you some of the best and brilliant ideas to fast track your way to success. Would you like an upgrade? Let's do this.
Also the former CEO of AirAsia X, and some of you may have flown that airline. And he was also involved in iFlix, a venture that dared to take on Netflix and the Silicon Valley. So please put your hands together and welcome Azran Osman Rani. Hi, Azran. Welcome.
Hi, Tanvi. Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited. I was just telling Azran just before we went on that I heard him for the first time in the CXO forum, and I instantly fell in love with his energy, his ideas, his journey. And so we just had to bring you on the show. I know how busy you are, so thank you for making the time.
Not at all. My pleasure.
All right. So, you know, as I kind of look at your trajectory, you know, you took like a startup to like a US 1 billion mark. You went, you know, you took the company to a public listing in 6 years in an industry which is very, very hard to shake up, namely the airline industry. If you had done it once, I would have said it was a fluke, you know, it happened. But you did it again, a second time. And that time was with iFlix.
Right.
And you had this, you know, audacious goal of trying to, you know, create something in Asia and take it to places and people who maybe didn't even have a television set in their house.
That is right. Mm-hmm.
Twice, maybe a fluke. Now you're on to a third venture with Naluri. And then you wrote a book, 30 Days and 30 Years.
Right.
If I put on my executive coaching hat, if I didn't know you, just saw this entire thing, the thing that strikes me is that you're a man who's not afraid of disrupting the status quo. You're a man who can't sit still and just has to take on the establishment. So tell us a little bit on where do you get that drive from and what keeps you going and taking, even one of these would have been quite enough to say, I'm hanging my boots and I'm going to write a book, which you did. But what keeps you going?
Oh, well, I think I get that question a lot. And upon reflection, I think a lot has to do with my childhood, my upbringing. One of the things both of us have in common is we come from academic families. So even as a young child, I was filled with a world of books. But more importantly, I think was, you know, even as a four-year-old, going home and having my parents, colleagues be there at dinner, and then they're asking me to explain ideas and challenge, you know, my thinking, you know, to all these professors in the room. And so at a very early age, you learn how to communicate your ideas and have to defend them and debate them with adults. And also, I think that meant, you know, very early on, the privilege that I got was to, coming from an academic background, is, you know, they say, well, just because someone has said that or that's what it's been written doesn't mean that's the absolute truth. And it's up to you to kind of challenge and push the boundaries and create knowledge rather than just be a recipient of knowledge.
Right. I am going to replay this video clip to my son, who I think is very much on the entrepreneurial track. And like any teenager, he has a healthy disdain for the academic institutions. So, you know, I think this is a good lesson about how, you know, the ability to challenge and think is a fundamental skill, even if you are going to be a serial entrepreneur like Azran, right?
Right. Because I think that the difference is the danger of just being kind of curious and entrepreneurial is you may end up being that rolling stone that gathers no moss. Mm-hmm. So one part of the academic approach is the questioning and the curiosity. But the other part is depth, because you've got to create knowledge. So it's not enough to just learn what's already out there, but how do you dive deeper so that you're actually now creating something new, right? And so that requires time and effort to put in.
And persistence, which you seem to have plenty of. So let's start at the beginning, right? So you join AirAsia, and then there's this idea of launching AirAsia X. We are already dealing with a low-cost carrier. And Tony Fernandez and you talk about this idea of having these wide body planes and flying international, which is not a bad idea, only that it, there are plenty of other low-cost carriers like Ryanair and all saying, well, it can't be done. And with plenty of good reason, because anybody else who tried failed miserably, right? So walk us a little bit through that journey of what allowed you to have that audacity with evidence in your face. So one thing is you launch something where you don't know if it's going to work or not, but then there's something else when you have an active, what should I say, group
resistance,
exactly. You shouldn't go that way, you know, it's a dead end and all of that. So, you know, it's such a fascinating journey. I'm going to hand over you to you to share with us what, you know, made you go in that direction and what led to the success of it.
Well, I think first, you know, it's an interesting point because many people associate AirAsia as a dynamic and innovative and risk-taking brand. But even that organization and that culture, the moment you become successful, you start to have very fixed beliefs about what made you successful, right? And it becomes suddenly hard to change. A lot of AirAsia's success was based on taking proven models from Ryanair and EasyJet and being the first to launch it in Asia, right? But then you're kind of like, this is what works. This is the Bible of the low-cost carrier model. And so, you know, when all of these people say, look, it cannot be done, you can't go long haul because, you know, the advantage that Ryanair has over, say, British Airways is that it does 8 flights in a day, these short haul flights, because it does these quick 25-minute turnarounds, whereas British Airways might only do 4 or 5 flights with one plane in a day. But in a long haul plane, you know, one way, maybe 8-10 hours, you come back another 8-10 hours, how are you going to squeeze multiple flights in a day to have a cost advantage over the legacy full service carriers? So these are assumptions that very quickly define, you know, they kind of bind your understanding, right? Because these are beliefs that you hold clearly. And I suppose number one, I didn't come in with answers. I didn't know how exactly we were going to approach it. But what attracted me was when someone says very clearly, no, some things cannot be done. They take a very dogmatic approach. And there's this little tinkering instinct part of me that says, ooh, I'd love to disprove the status quo. So, you know, that's kind of how when Tony was rejected by his own board members and shareholders, and he said, well, I'm gonna create a separate company and we have to apply for our own license and raise our own capital. And if everyone in the airline industry believes this cannot be done, let me go out and find someone gullible enough not to know that you can't do this. So that's kind of how I came into the picture.
So you were saved by what I call the curse of the expert, right? Because some of us who know a lot know too much for our own good. And so, you know, it's so fascinating for me because you were not an airline insider, so to speak, right? And yet you had to kind of get integrated into the industry, become an insider so quickly. What was the, you know, for the lack of a better word, approach that you took to kind of embody what might be the, you know, ethos of the industry or the approach of the industry? And I'll tell you why I'm asking that question. Because you see, in the age of disruption, and you know, the topic for today is embracing false disruption, one of the things we are seeing is that people will be changing careers multiple times in their life, not jobs, but careers. So I know of like Morgan Stanley bankers who may have, you know, turned bakers and bakers who are deciding to become life coaches. And, you know, it's unheard of. It's unheard of. And so what was it like for you to come in as an outsider and then, you know, take on the culture, the thinking, the approach and all of the industry while at the same time maintaining a certain distance because you don't want to become like one of them. Right.
Well, I guess, look, to be fair, you know, my first 10 years was as a management consultant where we got paid to question and challenge how things were being done. So there was that kind of formal foundation. And even after that, a few other businesses that I've been involved with were in situations where to create something new from scratch in a very fast manner. And I think for me, when I look into these situations, there's a specific discipline that I take, which is, you know, let me wear the hat of the consumer or the customer, right? And try to look for what are the unmet needs that the existing incumbents are missing because they're so focused on continuing their existing business model and operations. And the best example of that, right, is, you know, when first let me backtrack, right? And one of the other reasons why the global airline industry believed that long haul was not possible was to a large extent because this one piece of analysis that all these industry experts and even consultants did, right, which is to compare the unit cost of an airline against the flight time of each flight, right? So if a 1 hour flight, what's the average unit cost of a full service carrier versus a low cost carrier? And there is a unit cost difference. And if you plotted that with all the airlines around the world, you'll notice that kind of at about 4 hours, that unit cost differential disappears. So the natural conclusion is there is no longer a unit cost advantage going long haul beyond 4 hours. But what's the problem with being data driven? We're told to be data driven. What's the problem with being data driven?
I guess you are limited by the sample size that you have had because it's a range description.
This is just by every airline in the world. So the difference is data exists in the past.
Yes.
What's missing is a data point that hasn't been imagined yet.
Mm,
right. And so this is why sometimes data can be very limiting, right? Mm. Now, so in any industry, when I start, right, I try to understand some basic principles about how do we actually really serve our customers. And so when I looked at an airline as a business, right, I said, well, number one, why would people want to fly with you? Because you're going to where they want to go, which means, you know, like I've got to have a lot of planes, I've got to have a lot of destinations. Number two, they really want it affordable. Now, I don't say low cost. I use affordable because it's the language of our customer, right? Mm-hmm. The value that they get from you. Number three is, well, you can be cheap, but if you're not reliable, they're not going to use you, right? If you're not on time and you're not safe, they're not going to fly. And number four, well, you can be affordable and reliable, but if you're not convenient, it's not easy to use, they're not going to come back and use you. Okay. But very interestingly, once you set that framework and you start to understand, well, how do we create real meaningful differences in size, affordability, reliability, and convenience? And when we got to reliability, right, and we said, well, how do we know, how do we measure reliability? Well, it turns out, right, one of the key measurements for reliability in an airline industry is something called aircraft utilization, the number of hours that the plane is in the air versus when the plane is on the ground. Right. And if you were to Google Cathay Pacific's annual report and it will say average aircraft utilization, 12 hours a day. Now, I pick Cathay because it's one of the few airlines that's all big planes. They don't have sort of small planes. Right. And that kind of makes you go, huh, that's interesting. 50% of the time, the plane is on the ground. Right. Like you can't imagine a hotel, a data center, or shopping mall being run at only 50% capacity. It seems criminal. But why? Why do they do it that way? And this is why that curiosity comes in and you dig in, you're like, ah, the reason why they do that is because for these full service carriers, their priority is the people who fly at the front end of the plane, first class and business class, because those people, those seats may only be 18% of the seats on the plane, but they generate 40% of revenues and 60% of profits. So you really take care of those people. But the needs of those customers are actually quite different. Right? The people who fly business value convenience, right? Value predictability and you know, consistency of schedules, right? That is why, for example, have you noticed how a lot of long-haul flights leave at midnight?
Yeah.
Right? It leaves Changi at midnight and somehow conveniently arrives at Heathrow at 6 a.m., right? Arrives at Sydney at 6 a.m. Why? Yeah. Because the important business person works through all day, final dinner meeting, get to the airport. Then I get on the plane. I've got this nice, comfortable flatbed seat. And when I arrive at Heathrow at 6 a.m., right, I can clear immigration, shower, boom, 9 a.m., I've got my first meeting in the city. It's designed for the convenience of the business traveler. And for the business traveler, that means I need to know any day, like these people, they memorize airline schedules, right? SQ 333, departing Terminal 3. You know those people, right?
Yeah.
So that means I need, as an airline, I have to make sure that the flight times are all the same time every day. But what's the average flying time from Singapore to London?
I want to say like 13 hours.
Okay, so 13. Now, if you arrive in Heathrow, the fastest you can get 300 people off, restock, refuel, and 300 people on, it'll take you at least 1 hour. although I once did it in 38 minutes, but 1 hour, right? And then you've got to fly back another 13 hours. What's the total time that that plane has gone away?
Long enough to want to do something about it.
Well, 13 plus 1 plus 13 is?
27,
which is more than 24, which yes. means to have the same departure time every day, they needed more than one plane, right? And actually, they don't keep that plane in London for 1 hour because they keep that plane in 1 hour, right? If the plane arrives at 6, that means the plane has to depart at 7. But for a departure at 7, is that convenient for that business customer, right? That investment banker in London, what time would he or she have to get up in London to shower, get ready, get into the limo, get to Heathrow, check in, security clearance, get to the boarding gate for a 7 a.m. flight? What time would you have to get up?
Oh my gosh, I would say like maybe 3:34. That's which not I'm not going that way. I'm not doing that.
Right, exactly. So they leave the plane there, unused, idle, paying parking charges for a later departure time because it's all about the convenience of that customer, right? And if we say, well, hang on, everyone is an important investment banker in the City of London. What about people who want to fly for the first time in their lives? Or, you know, like they just need the cheapest available flight and it doesn't matter what the arrival or departure time is. So without one plane, we flew, let's say, Monday in the morning, Tuesday at lunchtime, Wednesday in the evening, and we had the world's highest aircraft utilization rate at almost 18 hours. Wow. No airline executive had thought about that before because, right, when you think about the examples of the earlier predecessors in low-cost long-haul, when it comes to airline schedules, what do they do? Oh, let's hire an experienced airline scheduler, right? So Oasis Hong Kong, for example, when they start cheap flights from Hong Kong to London, they probably went, oh, let's go get someone from Cathay. And someone from Cathay comes in and says, okay, we need to depart the same time every day. When that plane arrives in Gatwick, we're going to leave it there for 12 hours so that it's a great time to come back and arrive back at Hong Kong at a particular time. Because you bring your existing practices and mindsets and beliefs about how things should work.
Yeah, you're right. I think a lot of it has to do with the, you know, one part which we talked about was the expert's curse, right? You know too much. But then the other piece which I'm hearing you say is the cognitive biases that we kind of transfer over to other places because we kind of expect that is, you know, these are transferable and they're not always transferable, right? So somewhere having that beginner's mindset and maybe saying, instead of asking, you know, why, asking why not, is the way to kind of keep the expertise you have, but not get bogged down by it. So I think biases may have a lot to do with it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm someone who arbitrages bias.
Right. I have to ask you a provocative question, okay? Which is this. Again, putting on my you know, executive coaching hat. I have to wonder, Azran, someone like you who takes on the status quo, who's willing to be a beginner's mindset, this, and, you know, give up your biases and all of that. Do you think someone like you would have been quite as successful if you had been dropped into a traditional hierarchical organization, which is what most organizations are, even though they pretend to be flat, do you think you would have been successful?
I think if you had taken Azran from the last 25 years, probably not, right? Because I was always driven by, I thrived on uncertainty. I thrived on, like, you know, I don't know what's around the corner. And so predictability and consistency were things that enervated me. It did not energize me. But I think what I've learned looking back with the benefit of hindsight is, number one, these are all difficult things. And trying to do these things by yourself, you're going to burn out, right? And so how do you find people who work with, who complement the way you look at things and the way you get things done, and find a way of working together with people who are different with you? If you can get that right formula, I think, number one, you increase your chances of success. And secondly, right, I think when I look back at all the past frustrations and conflicts I would experience in these large organizations, I think now I would have approached it differently, right? I would have said, okay, well, I may have a certain view, and let's say the board may have a different view, right? But rather than saying, okay, it's either my way or you know, things are black and white. In life, things are never black and white, right? They're 50 shades of gray. So, you know, how do you define work? Or for example, if you know, you're in this, the higher authority says, no, we're going to stick to option A, and you really believe it's option B. But you say, okay, well, let's go with option A. But option A requires certain assumptions to be continually true. And right now we have to make those assumptions. But maybe in 3 months, 6 months from now, there's new data points that come in that can validate or invalidate whether that assumption is true. And if it doesn't turn out as what we believed, let's agree that it's now time to change. Because there's never any such a decision in life that is permanent, that once you go down that path, you cannot change again. And I think once I accepted that, that it became a lot more liberating, that that life is 50 shades of gray.
Right. I think what I'm really taking away from this is, you know, embracing the mindset of fluidity of assumptions, mm-hmm. and being open to revisiting what you thought were fundamental parameters. I mean, let's face it, the pandemic, if it has taught us anything, it is that all assumptions that you held as sacred at some point in time went out the window. And I, you know, we did the series earlier called The Crisis is the Curriculum. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a great time for all of us to start asking ourselves, what are the assumptions I may have made about my industry? What are the assumptions I may have made about my job? What are the assumptions right. I may have made about my career? That mm-hmm. now is a great time to kind of push past those assumptions and see where it can take us. Now, I'm all for the experimental mindset, Azran, all right? I'm one of the people who has no issues, you know, walking into a blue ocean. I kind of enjoy the peace and quiet, if nothing else. But one of the things that, you know, I always talk to my clients about, you know, every client of mine is, I want to be at the cutting edge. I want to be innovative. And I have to remind them. I said, you know, cutting edge is also the bleeding edge. Are you ready to bleed?
And you know, are you ready to lose all your hair?
Lose all your hair.
From the frustration of pulling it all out.
Exactly right. So, and that's where, you know, suddenly there are a few murmurs and people are looking at each other. And part of it is also the managing the failure that comes with rapid iteration, right? In the Silicon Valley, they love saying, you know, move fast, break things, fail forward and fail fast and all that, which is great. But when you're the person who's failing, right, and it hurts the ego. So one part of it is the resources part of it, but mm-hmm. ultimately what the market is saying is you're wrong. Have you ever been wrong, Azran? Oh, tell me a little bit about your time when you failed and what do you do to recover?
How many days do you have? Because it's a very, very long list. But I think before we get that, Tanvi, I think one important point about innovation and agility and disruption is before you disrupt something else, are you willing to disrupt yourself? Mm-hmm. What assumptions that you are currently holding, what beliefs that you've changed? And if you can't answer that with clarity and conviction about why were you wrong, it's going to be hard to be an innovator that right. you are not trying to prove other people wrong, because it has to start with you proving yourself wrong first.
Yeah. So that willingness, that humility, mm-hmm. the curiosity to be wrong and still recover is something that I think our executives really need to embrace. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we say things like, oh, I would like to be more, I hate that word, but for the lack of a better one, agile, right? Mm-hmm. But my boss won't let me or my company won't. And it kind of stifles innovation. Yeah. You know, as someone who has, let's talk about iFlix a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. Again, an industry that you had nothing to do with. Mm-hmm. And you, of all people, say, okay, we're going to take on Netflix. For goodness sake, who gets up and says, let's take on Netflix? Right? And you could have failed. Right. Even aligning people behind that vision is a yep. task to show them a land, to your point, that data exists in the future, not now. Mm-hmm. How did you carry people along with you?
Okay. Well, so first, just a bit of context, right? Number one, 115 investors rejected us when we first tried to pitch the idea, right? And clearly, because all of them said, well, you're five guys in Kuala Lumpur, and you want to take on this global Silicon Valley giant. What are you on, right? But it wasn't about pitching 115 times. It was pitching once, getting rejected, find out what they didn't like about it, and then taking that and say, okay, now let's tweak, right? 115 tweaks is amazing because it takes probably the first initial dumb idea, but you get refined, right? Like that pressure, that polish. So first, you kind of be willing to have to go through over 100 rejections, number one, right? And even if finally, like, investor number 116 says, hey, you know what? I think you guys are crazy enough to pull this off. I'm going to back you, right? And we like launched. Okay, great. Well, you know, one of the first things we did was, hey, let's take that Netflix model where we created this freemium model, right? Let me give you a free tier subscription for 30 days and entice you so that you start. And then after that, get you to pay for a subscription. And it's going to be only $2 a month. Such a low price. Surely people would do it, right? So with the startup capital that we raised, I spent $10 million just on rights for Malaysia alone, right? And within a few months, suddenly you realize, oh, the only people who are willing to convert from that 30-day free trial to a paid subscription were probably only about 150 of my own friends and family members who I arm-twisted them to pay for a monthly subscription, right? And so $2 times 150 people, you know, $3,600 per year and a cost of $10 million, you know, that's not a great business proposition, right? And then you're like, okay, well, what's the problem? Maybe it's payment channels, right? Because, you know, some people don't have credit cards or they don't use online banking. So we try different things. Well, actually, everybody has a mobile phone. What if we get them to either take out from their postpaid bill or charge on the postpaid bill or take out from the prepaid credit? And we launched it. We convinced the telco to say, hey, let's do this. And they said, wait, we like the idea. So we're going to bundle, like, for that $2, we're going to also throw in 1 gigabyte of data. And that 1 gigabyte of data is actually worth more than $2 on a standalone basis. And so surely you think now people will buy, right? Because even if they didn't like iFlix, they would pay the $2 to get that 1 gigabyte of data. Hardly, I think there were 226 people who bought, right? Like terrible, right? So again, another failure. And then we said, well, you know what? What's the number one payment channel in Southeast Asia for e-commerce, right? E-commerce has been booming, right, in Southeast Asia back in 2015. What would be your guess?
I have no idea. This is not my space at all, but I mean, the population of Southeast Asia itself is very, very sizable. So what's the number?
Something that people in Singapore can't get, which is it's actually cash on delivery, right? Cash is still a massive transaction. In fact, that's probably one of the main reasons how Grab overtook Uber was because they started accepting cash, right? But how does cash work with iFlix? Because we're not delivering a physical product, but we still experimented, right? We said, okay, for these people on day 29 of that free trial, I'm going to send you a message. Hey, Tanvi, thank you so much for doing our trial with us. If you'd like to continue on with the subscription, you can pay your $2 via credit card, online banking, through your mobile phone, or if you want, just click here and we'll send a guy on a motorcycle to your house to collect your $10 from you. And it costs more than $10 to pay the guy on the motorcycle to go to your house to collect $10 from you. But we did it because we needed to learn. And you know what we learned? They still did not want to pay. So now we're like, oh, right? And this is where you like nothing in your business plan materializes until, you know, life fortuitously, someone came up to me and says, hey, Azran, I know you. You're like one of the iFlix co-founders, right? And it said, I love your product. I watch it like 2-3 hours a day. I'm on my fourth free trial.
Oh, good Lord.
You see, now we realize people were watching iFlix, but they didn't want to pay for it. Because if you make them pay, they're going to pirate, right? But it's a better product than pirated content. They just didn't like the idea of paying for it. They'd rather, you know, at the end of 30-day free trial, I just sign up for a new trial account with a new email address, not hard, right? And kind of keep going. So now we're like, oh, okay, at least we know they like it. They just don't want to pay for it. Now, you could end there, but you say, well, who will benefit from people watching iFlix? The telcos, you see, because telcos, their core revenues of voice and SMSs have been decimated. And data is the only revenue that's growing, right? Mm-hmm. And video is the most data-intensive application. 70% of data online is video, right? Mm-hmm. So we then went back to the telco and said, hey, crazy idea. Let's bundle iFlix, right? No. So that when people buy a mobile package, they get iFlix included. Mm. And they said, no, right? In our model, we charge them and you keep 70% and we take 30%. That is the standard global telco model. And this is why you got to have to keep pitching and pitching. And finally, one friendly telco said, Azran, you're so annoying. Fine, we'll try this one experiment, right? Where, you know, for our postpaid customers, we're going to give them a free 12-month iFlix subscription. Yeah. And once we did that, right, we could see and show them the data that those who used iFlix were consuming on average 2 gigabytes a month of incremental data more than those who did not use iFlix, which meant, right, if the value, they pay us a wholesale fee, but they're actually getting more money from people buying additional data. So the model became like, hey, give your customers a free car and then sell them gasoline.
Yeah.
And that became the breakthrough. So my point of this is, breakthroughs don't come from your initial idea, initial brainstorming, right? It's your ability to go through that 115 rejections, go through the multiple disappointments and failures on payment channels until you get it.
Yeah. Right. I think apart from persistence, curiosity, experimental mindset, I picked up another very important one you just mentioned, which was the ability to be annoying until you have no choice. Yeah. You know, say, fine, come on with us. But I think it's an important point for leaders as well as companies to understand that the value in the value chain might come from a very different point of interaction than what you initially thought where the value might lie. And having that vision and that ability to keep filters wide enough to be able to spot alternate value generation points is very, very critical to then quickly repurpose the initial vision more in alignment from where the harvesting, you know, can happen. So that's been a lot of business talk. I'm going to talk to you a little bit.
Can I add one more? Sorry, right? Yeah. There's a survival mindset. And this is the difference between a corporate executive and an entrepreneur. And this is why I don't believe in stock options. See, stock options give you an upside, but no downside, right? And in both the case of AirAsiaX and iFlix, I had to put in my own money, right? And when you're at risk of losing your kids' education and all of that, right? When you get stuck, you will keep going in a way that a corporate employee might say, never mind, you know, I'll do something else, I'll move on, right? But you can't because you have so much invested, right? And that survival mindset is what kind of pushes you just that much, your pain threshold is that much higher.
Yeah. I just related to that point, I think there's also something to be said for burning the boats as the metaphor goes, right? Mm-hmm. When I transitioned from US back to Asia, and you know, I thought I was firmly on a particular career track and it was going to be academia and chair professorship and all of that. And then, you know, I decided to kind of set up my own thing. I had to in some ways close that option out and say, well, this is the option now. Now you better make it succeed because there's no going back. And I think that's kind of related to, you know, the employee mindset versus the ownership mindset. Mm-hmm. Are you renting space or are you owning it? The treatment of it is completely different, right?
That is right.
Yeah. So keeping in mind the time, I want to transition to talk to you a little bit about you yourself, not the CEO, not the entrepreneur and co-founder. One of the things I've heard you say in the past is that you are not a believer in willpower.
Yes.
Would you care to share with us why you would make a statement like that? I mean, I would have thought that, you know, willpower counts for so much when we want to get something done.
Well, see, the thing is, at the end of it, right, when we talk about willpower and determination, it is a conscious decision. But humans are actually not driven by consciousness and logic and rationale. We're highly emotional and we're highly intuitive, right? And so as much as we want to do something because we understand why we need to do it, but if it doesn't connect with what, you know, our brain likes things that are predictable and reliable and stable because it prefers doing the same thing over and over again because that's what it's used to. That is why, for example, 3% of people who start a diet fail, right? Gym memberships are full in January. By December, only 28% of people are left, right? People who get Fitbits in January, 90% of them have deliberately lost their Fitbits by December because the difference between I want to do it logically and what my emotional instincts kind of are more comfortable with are two completely different things. And so we need to learn how do we embrace what we want to do at a more emotional and intuitive level, rather than just purely like logic and the determination because you understand why.
Right. It's you're speaking to someone who does work on storytelling, and that's something that I tell all my clients and customers is like, you know, very often when people go to market, you know, in the tech world in particular, well, my cloud is whiter than your cloud, and my cloud is fluffier than your cloud. And I'm like, nobody cares.
That's right.
What's the outcome and what's the emotional connect? And you're right, we are fundamentally creatures of emotions first. And if we are not addressing that, then you know, any effort we might make in willpower will probably, you know, fall apart.
That's right.
So let's talk a little bit about what I would refer to as your own personal pandemic, right? You spent time in ICU, 84 days, and you're an Ironman athlete. That couldn't have been easy. Yeah, well, we have science to talk about what that was all about. Share with us a little bit about that and what kept you going? Because as someone who's always on the go, and let me assure you, a lot of the people who are watching the show right now are also the go-getters and the movers and shakers, make it happen. Right. Even being under house arrest in pandemic is bad enough. You were like on the hospital bed without the ability to go somewhere. How did you navigate that and what allowed you to then get out of it?
Okay, well, so first context, it was May 2018, 8:55 a.m., because that's when my Garmin watch died, was while I was cycling in my neighborhood, a car came from behind at very high speeds and knocked me out. I woke up on the operating theater with fractures in my skull, bleeding in my brain, thorax 4, 5, 6, 7, my vertebrae fractured, 3 of my 4 limbs were in a cast. And that just goes to you how life is just unexpected, right? We're going to get knocked down, in this case, literally. And as he lied on bed, the reality was, you know, that's where everything felt like it was crumbling, right? I had just started this new business. So what was going to happen to it? What's going to happen to my employees? Who's going to take care of my kids? Am I going to walk again, right? And the problem with that, I found myself focusing on these big existential questions, was that there were no answers, right? And when there are no easy answers, the problem is the brain just keeps playing these questions, these thoughts throughout your heads nonstop, right? And that's when it can be debilitating. Now, luckily for me, what I had was a very supportive group of people around me, right? Because part of what Nalari does is, you know, we have psychologists. And the way they helped me was to say, look, we can't find all these answers to these big questions, but let's focus on what are the answers that you can answer, or what's within your locus of control, which was, you know, for example, on day number 7, hey, can I scoot off the bed and try to stand up, even with one of my legs fractured? Like, let's just focus on that, right? And then after that, hey, let's take 5 steps. Can we do that, right? And the more you start to win these small things, then the more you're like, oh, okay, I think I can do this. I think I can do this, right? And you now, because the brain can't parallel process, our brains are one track, right? And so in order to shut off all these negative thoughts, I needed to think of something else that was actionable. And so my goal then became 5 steps to 10 steps. And by day 33, I was able to get on a treadmill and start walking 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Day 47, I could pick up the speed and start running. Day 62, I ran outdoors for the first time. And then day 84, I was back on a bicycle. And that gave me a surge of confidence to get back on the road, right? Because otherwise, I didn't want the experience to scar me from ever getting back on a bike on the road again. And once you start to kind of really conquer that, then my shoulder, my broken shoulder started to heal. And day 112, I was swimming in the pool again. And by that time, I already had a goal, which was day 174, was to go back to Ironman Triathlon in Langkawi and complete it.
Yeah. Wow. So it's all about, you know, the baby steps, the small changes, you know, that lead to big results. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that, you know, I have realized in the pandemic is that forward movement is movement, even if it's the smallest step.
Yep.
And direction matters more than speed. You know, as long as you're heading in the direction that you're supposed to be.
That's
someone
right.
who's kind of going even at the smallest rate will make it further than someone who's just like, oh, it's too long a journey. I can't kind of build this. To wrap up, I was hoping you could share with us a little bit about your book, 30 Days and 30 Years, which is such an interesting metaphor. Right. For everybody who's watching us right now, I think that, you know, Azran has shared so many insights. But this metaphor kind of sums a lot of his, and there's a book, and by the way, it's available on Amazon. It's on Kindle, so you can grab it right after this show. And I have a signed copy I'd like to show off a little bit as well. So tell us a little bit about the book, and what does that metaphor even mean, you know, 30 days and 30 years?
Well, so first of all, confession, this is my therapy, right? To be able to write down my past experiences and come to terms with all the many mistakes I made was very helpful. So frankly, this book was for me. It's just to be able to look back at the last 15 years and just say, well, where are all the different points that I screwed up and what would I do it differently? And one of the biggest lessons for me was thinking that I knew the answers, right? And I look back, I literally, for example, with it was AirAsiaX or iFlix, even now, every single year, nothing that we put in our business plan, our budgets ever came through. Because the world was just changing too fast. And that's when I realized, but yet the whole business world was very focused on this annual cycle. It's an arbitrary amount of time that it takes the earth to go around the sun. And yet we worship that timeline, right? And we even say, well, that's my New Year's resolution, annual plans, annual budgets, annual performance appraisals. And instead what I realized is, what if we could change that and just say, well, actually what matters is not that particular planning horizon or even 3 to 5 years, but a much shorter one and a much longer one. So 30 days and 30 years. So 30 days means I've got to be super crystal clear what my priorities are over the next 30 days and, you know, rapidly iterate. But every single 30 days, if not sooner, I've got to pause and reflect and think, what do I need to change? Because I need to be aware of what are the changes around me, in my environment and in my ecosystem, that I've got to do something very different every single month. But if it's just speed alone, without any kind of principles or direction, that is where you're going to get lost. It's like a headless chicken running around in circles. And 30 years for me was the way to create that compass. Because if you define your 30-year goal, how are you going to change society and how do you really make a difference to people's lives, you no longer have to worry about budget constraints and timelines and, you know, resources or even technology, because you get to imagine things that don't exist today, right? And if you can focus on that, then it allows you to distill the essence of your existence, right? And that is why that gives you the compass on every 30 days. Like, I've got 10 different things I want to do. I've got capacity for only 3. How do I decide which 3? Well, which 3 will be the strongest contributors to my 30-year vision?
Yes. It's kind of like, you know, the zoom in, zoom out kind of thinking, as I use it.
Yes, that's right.
Like, yep. How far can you zoom out to be able to get beyond the resource constraints and, you know, everything that might go wrong with your life in, you know, that time? And then at the same time, but what I really liked about the book was this idea that, you know, even within the 30 days, you have to be open to course correction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we are already seeing how quickly the world changes. That ability to kind of, you know, revisit plans on a 30 day is it's long enough for data to come in, and it's short enough to not get wedded to ideas that actually need
that.
Right. So that's kind of the beauty of it. And like I said, it's available on Amazon and Kindle. So you can get it right after this. So as we kind of wrap up, again, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. Are there any final words of wisdom or thoughts that you want to leave us with as we, you know, look at being more successful in this world of disruption?
Well, so it's interesting, right? Because disruptive forces are actually triggers of stress, right? Because they make us uncomfortable, right? And humans, we don't like stress, right? And a lot of people will already know about things like cortisol and adrenaline that surge to our body that put us in this fight or flight syndrome. But what people know less about is that there's another hormone that surges when we're experiencing these stressful threats. And that hormone is oxytocin. It's a social hormone. It's the cuddle hormone, the love hormone, the hormone between a mother and a newborn baby to build that human bond. Because tribes were how we survived as a human species. The togetherness, right? So when we're faced with harsh winters and droughts and predators chasing after us, on our own, we're not going to survive. But if we figure out how to band together, that's how we're going to get through it. Mm. Right. So in a way, when I knew that, that was why I became very interested to launch Naluri. Right. Because of all the challenges that I faced, I realized the only thing that got me through everything was that I had much better people around me. Right. People who are much smarter, people who had lots more industry experience, people who are a lot calmer than me. Right. And so when I no longer defined about these things as about me and what I do, but rather the support structure that I can create around me, that was literally how I got through everything. And so now I want to figure out, how can I do that at scale? How can everyone get access to a whole team of professionals to help them through with their motivations and mindsets and challenges and problem-solving skills across a journey to achieve goals that may be stressful and daunting?
Yeah, I would encourage everybody to also check out the Naluri website. I think it is very much, the next iteration of us getting through, you know, things like pandemics and disruptions, et cetera, which is recognizing that there is the strategy part of it, there is the talent part of it, there is the plan part of it, but there is the humanity of it.
The emotional part, yes.
The emotional part of it. And how do we kind of create that support structure? And as is famously said in Africa, in, you know, Ubuntu, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. So here's hoping everybody who's tuned in goes very far. As Ran, we wish you a ton of good luck on all your endeavors. Many more to come. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you everyone who joined in. Make sure you grab hold of the book that's available on Amazon, 30 Days and 30 Years. Thanks so much. Thank you, Ran. Bye. Bye-bye.
That concludes this episode of Leaders Upgraded. But wait, your journey is just getting started. Go to www.leadersupgraded.com for more insights, more inspiration, and more tools to continue the journey. And if you have someone who you would like to nominate for the podcast or a particular topic you'd like us to cover, then also visit www.leadersupgraded.com and let us know. If you like this episode, please do share it. Please do subscribe to the podcast. And I look forward to continued upgrades with you. Take care.